I, for one, wouldn't mind a second trip, said Moose. He had been targeted by a music shop owner. After repeated statements that he neither played nor desired to learn the sousaphone, the bachraca and David, or the pandemonium, he had accepted the gift of a contrabass violin which the shop owner insisted had just sat around there since forever. Moose strongly doubted that, considering the new item, only 3,500 marks, tag on the case. One look at the electrocardial schnoots taking up one entire wall of the shop, though, had convinced him that it could be worse. He could at least carry the bass fiddle. And he was intrigued by the miniature set of tuned Hoffmanite orchestral anvils in the discount section. For future purchase, perhaps. Along with the bass fiddle, Moose carried the overflow of Jacron's load. Jacron had become the subject of a bizarre bidding war in reverse, with a group of shopkeepers competing to see who could pile more free merchandise onto the stunned Narn. The eventual winner had been the bookstore owner, a Cardassian expatriate who proved himself a faster and more verbose talker than even Jacron, and by the time Mac pulled the paper contract out of the dazed Narn's hands, Jacron's entire wardrobe had been replaced. He owned a copy of every book by every prophet Narn revered, a golf bag had been slung over his shoulders, and a plateful of the highest quality gourmet spoo had been stuck into his mouth. Not the spoo, the plate. Jacron had been forced to hold it in his teeth until Azalin removed it. Everyone knew that when Jacron's brain completed the inevitable rant on this subject, it would be a doozy. Mac found himself rather looking forward to it. The group staggered into the Hilton lobby, laden with the products of a very strange generosity. The procession stopped cold as Mac froze, stood to attention, and saluted a stern, middle-aged man wearing dingy ship's coveralls. Of average height and stocky build, and bald as a cue ball, the older man returned the salute and muttered, "At ease, Cord." As the group eased around Mac into the lobby, they noticed that the man wasn't alone. A brunette in a plain, no-nonsense dress, hair done up in a bun, stepped over to join the long-faced man beside Mac. Behind her was a woman fighting, and losing, the Battle of the Bulge, hand in hand with a tall, swarthy man possessed of a perpetual smile and pencil-thin mustache. Behind them all stood a young woman with raven-black hair and a stately old woman of at least a century's age, hair solid white from scalp to shoulder. The stocky man to whom Mac had saluted began looking him up and down, inspecting with a cool, analytical gaze. He walked halfway around Mac, noted idly the immense mass of McEachern blocking his path, and returned to the front. "You look fairly well, Cord," he said at last. "I trust you have been given proper attention to your studies, despite this lamentable state of affairs." "Aye, Captain," Mac said. "I had never expected you to take after your grandfather," the stocky man continued. "Risks, danger, excitement. I thought you didn't like those things." "It was necessary, sir," Mac replied simply. The stocky man accepted this, nodding approval. "Just don't make a habit of it. There is a surplus of adventure-seeking fools, and a severe lack of serious-minded people today." Looking around the other students, he added, "I hope you and your friends didn't sign any endorsements this morning." "I don't think so, sir," Mac said. "A few holograms, nothing more." "Good, good," the stocky man said. "Ladies and gentlemen, I am Cyrano Mackenzie, captain of the private freighter Aurochs. You are well acquainted with my son Cord." He gestured to Mac, who still stood at an aggressive parade rest. "This is the rest of our family. My wife, Shirley," nodding to the woman in the bun. "My sister Jasper and her husband, Frederico dos Santos." And the pair bowed deeply, Jasper following her tall husband's lead. "Their daughter, Caspia. And my mother, Emerald Mackenzie." The young lady smiled as Emerald stepped forward and hugged Mac, then shook hands with the rest of the WPI students. Mac, in turn, introduced the various WPI students, barely getting through the group before a startled female squeal from across the lobby drew attention to the occupant of a hover chair, who had just goosed a maid in passing. "Oh, blast," Cyrano grumbled. "Mom, I thought you were keeping an eye on him." The hoverchair's occupant, giggling madly, made a beeline for the large group. The occupant was ancient, 200 years old if a day, skin and bones, one very lonely lock of silver hair in the center of his scalp. A black patch covered one eye socket, and a walking cane with a silver skull head on top poked from the blanket covering his lap. "Emerald's grandfather," Cyrano sighed, gesturing introduction. "The dread pirate of Corellia, Commodore Koros Belbendi." Belbendi waved cheerfully at the little group.
"Well, if it isn't little Harry! And how is my little space marine doing, huh?"
"I apologize," Cyrano muttered to the others. "He's quite senile. We had to take him in 4 years ago when we found him on Obroa Sky trying to recruit a crew." "Is he..." Azalin reconsidered her question. "Was he really a space pirate?" "Over 100 years ago, yes," Cyrano muttered. "He was defeated twice by Wedge Defense Force ships before the collapse. He sold out his operations to the CFMF almost 90 years ago in exchange for amnesty, but these days..." He gestured to the old man, who was describing sword battles and blaster shootouts that Mac doubtless had led to victory, while Mac smiled and nodded pleasantly through. "Cord," Cyrano said, breaking through Belbendi's random chatter, "I came here to offer you transport from here to the Republic of Zeta Cygni. The home fleet will relocate there after the christening ceremonies for the station are complete, but Captain Hutchins has expressed his hope that you'll reside in New Avalon as his guest until things quieten down again. Your friends are welcome to join you, of course, but it will take us a few days to reach Zeta Cygni, so they may wish to use faster transportation." Before anyone could reply, Mac's communicator beeped for his attention. Looking faintly surprised, he took it from his belt, flipped it open, and said, "Mackenzie here." "Midshipman Mackenzie," came the clipped voice of Commander Typhon, the second officer of the New Orleans. "Orders from Home Fleet. You are to escort your charges to Transporter Room 1 at 1200 hours sharp for transport to Babylon 5. Have all personal effects either present or tagged for transport from the hotel." Mac's brow furrowed. "But," he said. "Upon receiving quarters assignments," Typhon continued as if he hadn't heard the midshipman's objection, which was likely, "you will then proceed to IPS Challenger no later than 1300 for lunch at the captain's table."
"Sir, I..."
"That gives you 87 minutes, midshipsman," said Typhon pointedly. "Better get moving. Any questions?" He added, in a tone that made it perfectly clear that there had better not be. "No, Commander. Orders acknowledged. Mackenzie out." Mac closed the communicator, put it back on his belt, and gave his father a chagrined look.
"Bah!" Koros Belbendi spat. "Stinkin' rear echelon, motherfuck—"
"Grandfather," said Emerald primly. For his part, Cyrano Mackenzie didn't bat an eye. "Well, that's settled," he said with a firm nod. "If you'll excuse us," he added to the others, "I wish to debrief Midshipman Mackenzie in private before he has to leave. Cord, follow me." A few brief farewells later, the Mackenzie clan and the WPI students parted, the students for their hotel rooms and the Mackenzies to return to their ship. Mac followed his father down the corridor to one of the Hilton's smaller meeting rooms, which lay empty at the moment. Cyrano opened the door, gestured Mac inside, and followed, closing the door behind him. Father and son faced each other for a long, uncomfortable moment. Finally, Cyrano stepped forward, dropping all formality, and hugged Mac tightly, rocking on his feet with emotions he hadn't allowed himself to show in public.
"Thank God you're home, son," Cyrano whispered. "Thank God you're home."
The duelists and their friends, Les Amanda and Devlin, who were still confined to Medlab on Babylon 5, entered the Starship Challenger's officer's mess with some trepidation. Few of them had ever been aboard a military starship before, and none except Kate, Utina, and Mac quite knew what would be expected of them. Mac had acquired a new dress uniform and was looking his absolute sharpest. None of the rest were quite so formal. They couldn't be, having no clothes but what they'd brought with them and little money with which to buy new ones. Most of them still wore somewhat rumpled WPI uniforms. Jacron's sudden wealth of clothing from the New Orleans was all casual wear, unsuited for any formal occasion. Since arriving on Earth, only Utena and Corwin had been able to change. One of her Otori uniforms had still been in her duffel bag after her trip to the moon, and he'd had a couple of changes stored aboard Dagger Disc for emergencies. What they found was an unintimidating room, one level below and just aft of the bridge. Rather intimate, really, considering the size of the ship. It had a nice view of the rear half of the main hull's dorsal surface and the warp nacelles. If there were any activity in the either of the ship's shuttle bays, it would have been observable from here. That was, in fact, the room's primary purpose. Griffin had transformed it into a dining room for the command staff as a kind of afterthought, when no one in the virtual reality simulation prototype of the ship ever used the place for its intended purpose. The room's main feature was a long rectangular table which could seat 20. Griffin, who had been standing near one of the big windows, turned at the sound of the door and smiled. "Thank you, Jansen," he said. "Sir," said the crewman who had conducted the guests up from the transporter room, and he excused himself. Mac stepped forward, came stiffly to attention, saluted sharply, and declared, "Midshipsman Harcourt M. McKenzie, CFMF, reporting as ordered, Captain." Griffin gave him an odd look, then returned the salute as a matter of form. "At ease, midshipsman. It wasn't an order, just an invitation." Mac relaxed into that aggressive parade rest again and said, "That wasn't the way I heard it, Captain." "That's true," Azalin observed. "They were pretty sharp about it." She screwed up her face and did a surprisingly good impression of Commander Typhon's dry voice. "Upon receiving quarters assignments, you will then proceed to IPS Challenger no later than 1300 for lunch at the captain's table." "Sounds like a real party animal, that one," Nall remarked from Corwin's shoulder. Griffin chuckled. "It appears somebody in Home Fleet Command got a little overzealous. I'm sorry about that, Mr. McKenzie. I only intended to offer you and the rest of Kate's friends lodging aboard B-5 and lunch up here if you wanted them. I hope the misunderstanding didn't drag you away from something important." "It's taken care of for now, sir," said Mac. "Good," responded Griffin with a nod. "Anyway, will you please relax? You're giving me a tension headache. I haven't seen anybody stand like that since I was at Starfleet Academy." "Gladly," Mac muttered, reaching up and rubbing his neck a bit. "Sorry about the martinet bit, but my father taught me to act respectful to authority figures." A familiar wry smirk appeared on his face as he added, "He never did manage to teach me to be respectful, though." Griffin chuckled, gesturing Mac and his group into the dining room. "I've always had problems with that myself," he said. "Something about feeling that respect ought to be earned." Mac nodded agreement, then looked genuinely confused as his brain did a quick rewind on Griffin's words. "I wasn't aware you'd been in Starfleet, Captain," he said. "Different universe," said Griffin, grinning. "Have a seat, and I'll tell you all about it over lunch. I apologize for the absence of some of my officers," the captain went on as she showed the kids to their seats. "But we don't have enough crew for full shift rotation yet, and somebody's got to watch the store." The partial command staff of the Starship Challenger proceeded to treat their guests to the best lunch any of them had had in some time. Indeed, since coming to Babylon 5, the former WPI students had been eyeing the food processors with a slightly dubious air, not because they disliked the unit's output, but because, after a year of WPI food, they couldn't quite believe that it was possible to feed large groups of people that well. Here in the Challenger officers' mess, though, the food was an order better than that, prepared by hand and served by uniformed crewmen with towels over their arms and perfect manners. "We're kind of an informal force," Griffin informed them with a grin. "But for special occasions, we know how to turn ourselves out." He raised his glass. "To the Institute Duelist Society."
"Kai du sak, hai winuk,"
blared Science Officer Klang.
Kai,
replied his cousin Krog, late of the WPI Languages Department, and Dutan Atenjo, his favorite student. Now, said Griffin, once they'd all drunk to that and dug into their meals, here's the program for today. I have a million things to chase this afternoon, so I won't be able to spend much time with you. But it's all for a good cause, trust me. Lieutenant Tuvek and Subcommander Klang here will take good care of you, though. While I'm hiding in my office taking care of business, they're going to take you out and show you one of the coolest things in this sector, the Denorius Belt. After that, we'll head back here. Earth Force should be delivering your stuff about then. What kind of business? Wakaba Shinohara asked with a there's more to this, I just know it kind of look. Griffin grinned at her. You'll find out, he said, and wouldn't be budged on the subject for the rest of the meal. He told them about some of his experiences in an alternate universe Starfleet instead, such as the first time he'd commanded a ship named Challenger. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, Susan Ivanova, bored out of her mind on the command deck of the station, was surprised to see the Metaspace jump gate open. There were no more material shipments scheduled, the station was physically complete. The full staff wasn't due for another 2 days, the diplomatic corps for 2 weeks. There was a Starfleet ship expected later in the day, but it wouldn't be here yet, and anyway, it wouldn't be coming by Metaspace. She was doubly surprised when the Metapoint disgorged a single ship, small and angular but nasty-looking, her snubbed weapons emplacements and sharply angled armor making it clear that she was built for a fight. Ivanova recognized the markings immediately, but before she could say anything, the Starfleet ensign on the sensor board was already reporting. Gamelon Destroyer, Katale class. She's hailing. On screen, said Ivanova. She got up from the deck officer's chair and tugged down on her uniform tunic. The things were comfortable and a whole lot better looking than the Starfleet uniforms of her early career, but the jackets did have an annoying tendency to ride up a bit if you sat down. This is Lieutenant Commander Susan Ivanova of the IPO Space Station Babylon 5, she announced. Please identify yourself. The screen beeped and showed Ivanova a lean-faced young Gamelon man with hair so black it was nearly blue and glowing red eyes.
Hello there, he said, sounding slightly distracted. This is His Gamelon Majesty's Destroyer Vengeance, Commander Garen Dessler commanding. That would be me, by the way, Garen Dessler.
Ivanova frowned thoughtfully. Garen Dessler? As in Prince Garen, the black sheep of the Gamelon royal family? She wondered if he'd become a black sheep by having bad comm presence, or if he was really as inept as he sounded. What a weird world it was. Yesterday, the Gamelon Navy had come within about a minute of wiping out all life on Ivanova's home planet. Today, she was welcoming a Gamelon prince as an ally and telling him it would be her pleasure to give him a mooring location and receive him aboard. When he was gone for the screen, she touched the call button on the Mark II communicator stuck to the back of her hand. She preferred them to comm badges, and said, Ivanova to Kira. Go ahead, replied the slightly tinny voice of Major Kira Nerys, the station's chief of security. Major, a Gamelon destroyer has just pulled up alongside. It seems Prince Garen is anxious to visit his sister.
Wonderful, replied Kira sourly, and Ivanova reflected with a wry smile that at least she and the Bajoran were in agreement about something for once.
I'd like you to post someone to keep an eye on him and his party while they're aboard. Not that I don't trust them, you understand, but...
Understood, the security chief replied. I'll put one of my best men on it. Kira out.
Ivanova tabbed her communicator off, sat down in the deck officer's chair, and sighed.
Problem? Came Commander Johnson's voice from the door to his office.
Ivanova swiveled to face him.
Oh, no, sir, she said, shaking her head with exaggerated assurance.
There's a Gamelon destroyer parked outside, a Starfleet ship due in from Earth in 2 hours, and Challenger's out giving a group of schoolchildren a tour of the Denorius Belt. No problem.
Jer nodded as if completely oblivious to his deputy's sarcasm, which, Ivanova had come to realize, was a higher grade of sarcasm all its own.
The commander replied absently, "Good, good," before turning and going back into his office. Ivanovich sighed a little deeper and muttered something darkly in Russian. "Good afternoon, Your Highness," said the trimly jumpsuited IPO security officer who met Garin and his party in Transporter Room C after the Gamelons had finished materializing. "Commander," said Garin. "No, sir. I'm a lieutenant," said the officer. "Oh," said Garin. "Well, work hard, eat right, and you'll be promoted one day," he added absently. "I'm a commander. You should call me that. I gave up being a prince," he added with a broad wink. "Too much work." "Ah," said the security officer. "Well, commander, I'm Lieutenant Malcolm Reed, and on behalf of the International Police Organization, I'd like to welcome you to Babylon 5. Garin looked around, nodded. "Very fine, very fine," he said. "I'm Commander Garin Dessler, Destroyer Vengeance, you know. This is my executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Cormel Dragonar." The taller and slimmer of the two similar-looking red-headed Gamelon women who had accompanied the prince nodded to Reed and smiled an elegant smile. "Ma'am," said Reed, nodding. "And Flight Officer Kitarina Dragonar," Garin went on, indicating the shorter, more, well, the only word Reed could come up with was voluptuous, of the two. "Sisters," the security officer thought. "Well, well." But he kept his face neutral and his voice polite as he greeted her as well. "Lieutenant, we don't wish to keep you from your duties," said Cormel. "If you could please direct us to wherever it is Commander Dessler's sister is staying, we won't take up any more of your time." "Well, Lieutenant Commander," said Reed with a smile, "as it happens, you are my duties at present. So, if you'll follow me..." Julian Bashir, M.D., considered himself to be among the happiest men in Starfleet, which was pretty funny, really, since Admiral Tordek had seemed positively apologetic when he gave Bashir the assignment. The poor man hadn't known what to do when the young doctor had thanked him, then informed the flag officer that he, Bashir, had in fact requested the assignment. The competition hadn't been stiff. Nobody else in Starfleet Medical wanted anything to do with this place. The Epsilon Eridani system was a backwater. If not for the Babylon project, it wouldn't have received a Medigate for years, if ever. Add to that the inevitable problems with the station's joint administration and the fool's errand that most of Starfleet thought the whole idea was in the first place, and you didn't have a lot of officers scrambling for the posting. Dr. Bashir, however, was extremely pleased and felt very lucky to have won it. Whether the state's function, providing a meeting place for the nations of the known galaxy to prepare defenses against possible extragalactic threats, was a fool's errand or not, he neither knew nor cared. Bashir had no interest in politics, which was often as much a gift as a hindrance. He didn't care one bit whether the place's diplomatic corps achieved marvels of a historic note or simply bickered. The important thing was they were coming, and so was everybody else. As soon as it went online, Babylon 5 would become a crossroads in the galaxy, bringing together people from hundreds, thousands of species and cultures, and he, Dr. Julian Bashir, would be right in the thick of it. Where else in Starfleet could a young physician, even one as handsome and brilliant as he was, find himself in command of a staff so large, so competent, so broad in scope? Where else could he be assured of a clientele as varied, vibrant, and exotic? Nowhere. No, sir, this was where the action was going to be. Still, right now, with the station only partially staffed and most of the diplomatic corps not on site as yet, things were a bit slow. There were journals to read and bulletins from Starfleet Medical to keep up with, of course, but Bashir was a fast reader, so he spent a lot of his time hanging around on the Zocalo talking with the Freespacers and that fascinating Cardassian fellow who claimed to be a tailor. He'd tried to chat up Lieutenant Commander Ivanova once, but after she'd asked him with bright-eyed interest whether he thought he could set his own broken arm or would need an orderly to help him with it, he'd tabled that project for the moment, which had left him right back where he'd started. As such, though he certainly deplored the circumstances which had led to their injuries, he found himself rather glad to have customers now. Anyway, there wasn't anything seriously wrong with any of them. just contusions, cuts, some neural shock. The young man had a nasty gash on his face, but it had been cleaned and responded very well to the protoplasia. So despite the fact they were still here for observation, none of his current patients really needed anything from their doctor at the present time. How fortunate for him, then, that someone had brought another to his door. A truly wretched individual, suffering from chronic malnourishment, three different kinds of parasitic infestation, a nasty skin condition, and fairly severe displacement shock. Yes, indeed, putting this fellow right had been a challenge worthy of Julian Bashir. Why, it had taken him very nearly all morning, but now, after a heroic struggle, "I think he'll be just fine," said a smiling Bashir as he delivered the gray cat back into the arms of his owner. "He's had a systemic flush and a bath. I've given him something for that nasty skin irritation, and he's up to date on all his immunizations. A little good food and attention, and I should think he'll do just fine. For your information, he seems to be about a year old, and he'd already been fixed. Fine-tempered fellow," Bashir added conversationally, scratching the cat's ears and listening to him purr. "I can't imagine what could have possessed his previous owners to abandon him like that. What's his name again?"
"Peril," replied Dorothy Wainwright as she adjusted the cat in her arms. When he'd come in, the animal had been dirty, skinny, patchy, and shaky. Now he was clean and glossy, still skinny and a bit patchy, but quite content-looking.
"Thank you, Doctor. I apologize for asking you to work outside your field, but the station doesn't have a veterinarian."
"Not at all," said Bashir. "As a xenophysician, I have to be ready to work on anything. Just because it's not sentient doesn't mean it's beneath me."
He petted the cat's head as if to prove that there were no hard feelings. "And how are you feeling today? I understand you all had a very traumatic experience yesterday. No aches, pains, shock symptoms?"
"I'm a robot, Doctor," Dorothy replied, the corner of her mouth cocking just the tiniest bit in the smile direction as she read his startled reaction.
"But thank you for your concern," she added after pausing for a beat in order to enjoy it.
"Ah, well," said Bashir. Then he smiled gamely and said, "In that case, if you've any physical complaints, you'd best find Chief O'Brien. The man's a wizard with mechanical systems and whatnot."
Dorothy humored the young doctor by thanking him for the tip, rather than informing him that, had she any physical repair needs, they could be most efficiently met by her owner. She would have gone on to thank him once more for his care of Peril, but just then the doors opened and four people came in. Dorothy recognized one of them, Rena Dragonar, Amanda Dessler's friend who had dropped in on one of the Art of Noises trips to Toronto a few weeks earlier, and could extrapolate from resemblances and anecdotal evidence the identities of two others, Amanda's elder brother and Rena's elder sister. The fourth was a human in an IPO security uniform. Dorothy nodded in greeting to Rena, who seemed a bit preoccupied, and made her way out. Bashir put on his winningest smile and went to introduce himself to his guests. They were a preoccupied lot, and didn't pay Bashir a lot of attention. He recognized their lack of interest for what it was, showed them to the isolation areas they wanted, and excused himself. Reed accompanied him, leaving the visitors to have some privacy. As soon as the door closed behind the young doctor and the security man, Garen Dessler abandoned his pretense of amiable idiocy and strode to his sister's bedside, taking her hand in his as Rena Dragonar took the other.
"Amanda," said Garen, "how are you feeling?"
"I'm fine, Garen," Amanda replied, sounding a bit irritable. "I was fine yesterday, and I'm fine today. That idiot doctor insisted on keeping me here for observation, though as far as I know he's observed very little." She made a frustrated noise. "Every minute I waste here is another minute for Xenia to find a better hiding place. But there is nowhere in this universe that she can hide from me."
Garen arched an eyebrow. "You're so certain she was responsible?"
Amanda nodded. "The fool she used as her instrument identified her. I will have to ask her why she was so careless as to make direct contact before I kill her."
"Father won't be happy about that," said Garen ruefully.
He wasn't happy when I nearly disintegrated him yesterday, either, but he got over that, and he'll get over this.
Garen blinked. So did Rena, opposite him. So, for that matter, did Coromel behind him, which brought a small smile to Amanda's hard-set, angry face. Rarely was Cora Dragonar fazed by anything.
"Well," said Garen, "the things I miss patrolling the Romulan frontier."
Squeezing Amanda's hand, he turned to the other bed, where Devlin Carter lay sleeping. The bruises on the young man's face had faded. Bashir's skilled hand with the protoplaser had reduced the gash on his cheek to a thin red line. It would leave a narrow scar, but only because Devlin had insisted on it, much to Bashir's chagrin. The young surgeon was a bit of a perfectionist and hated leaving things unfinished that way.
Garen turned back to Amanda, his expression one of surprised interest.
"You marked him?"
"I thought they might leave him alone if I did," said Amanda. "How much have you heard?"
"Not much," said Cora. "Only that a group of WPI students were involved in an altercation with the Psi Corps yesterday and had been evacuated to Babylon 5. We knew, of course, that you had to be involved."
Amanda smiled. "A logical assumption," she said. Then she seemed to realize that something was amiss to her right, turned, and said in astonishment, "Kit, are you crying?"
"Of course I'm crying, you stupid bitch!"
bawled Rena Dragonar, burying her tear-streaked face in the bedclothes on Amanda's chest.
"You and Carter nearly got killed. Again? And where was I? Where was I? What good am I?"
Amanda sighed and stroked her oldest friend's thick, disorderly red hair.
"It's not your fault, Kit. I ordered you to go away."
"I know," Rena replied miserably. "Why? What did I do?"
Amanda blinked.
"You didn't do anything. It wasn't a punishment. I didn't want to interfere with your career."
"To hell with my career," Rena replied. "You are my career, Amanda."
She raised herself, looked Amanda in the eye, and said,
"I went into the Navy because you did, not because I care a damn about it. Damn it, Amanda. You're more than my best friend, more than my lover. You're a Dessler. I'm a Dragonar. Sometimes I think you've never understood what that really means."
Amanda stared at her friend in open astonishment, then looked from her to her elder sister, then to Garen, who stood with his arms folded, impassive. Then her gaze shifted back to Rena again, and she nodded, solemn.
"Perhaps I haven't," she said.
I'm sorry, Kitarina. I've mistreated you, thoughtlessly."
Rena looked back at her, smiled wanly, and said in a small voice,
"So, you won't send me away again?"
"No," Amanda said. Rena's smile broadened. She leaned forward and kissed Amanda with considerable fire, leaving the princess slightly breathless when they separated.
"Okay, then,"
she said brightly. Amanda smiled and sat up straighter, bunching the covers in her lap and crossing her legs to lean forward.
"If you really want to prove your worth as a retainer," she said teasingly, "get me out of this place."
Rena touched her shoulder briefly, then walked around Garen and stood surveying Devlin.
"Is he all right?"
"He will be," Amanda replied. "He took a tremendous neural shock, telepathic combat with a Psycop, and quite a beating, but he's been resting comfortably since last night."
"Huh."
Rena touched the mostly healed slash on his face.
"You did mark him."
"I didn't think the Corps would be foolish enough to meddle with a Gamelon princess's battle prize."
"More fool I," said Amanda with wry bitterness. "They phasered us both. Father nearly destroyed their world for it."
She sighed, then went on. "At any rate, we've escaped them, and they've escaped the fate their folly entitled them to."
"What's to stop them from coming after him again?" Cora wondered.
"Me,"
Amanda replied flatly.
And me, Rena insisted. You promised.
Amanda smiled.
Of course, Kit, but that's not what I meant.
She looked around for Bashir, didn't see him, and climbed down from the bed, crossing to look down at Devlin. Then she turned to Garin, met his eyes, and said,
With your permission, brother, I intend to marry him.
Garin looked back at her for a moment, then at Devlin, then back to Amanda, his long face expressionless. Then it broke into his rather stupid smile, and he brayed cheerily,
Oh, jolly good! Any excuse for a party, eh?
Garin, said Amanda, please, be serious. Like a switch had been thrown, Garin reverted to his true self.
Sorry, he said. Habit.
He placed his hands on Amanda's shoulders and looked her in the face.
You know I'll support you, Amanda, in any endeavor. Carter is a good man. I count him among my very few real friends. You know that, too. For what little it's worth in the public eye, you have my support in this as well.
Without a word, Amanda embraced her brother, laying her head on his shoulder. In this room, in front of these four people, as with almost no others she knew, she could permit herself the luxury of breaking down, just a little, after the rigors of the last 2 days.
Hey, said Devlin's voice, quiet and wry. You bastard, you've made her cry.
Garin grinned and shook Devlin by the hand before Rena swooped in and tested the mending telepath's lips for a few seconds.
That, Devlin remarked, is quite a thing to wake up to.
Devlin, said Amanda, gathering back her composure slightly, Garin has just given us his permission to marry.
Oh, well, that's sporting of you, my lord, said Devlin.
Not a bit of it, old son, Garin replied. Happy to help.
Have you given any thought, asked Cora with a mischievous look, as to when?
Not particularly, Amanda replied. We've several things to do first.
To start,
she drew herself up into a more military bearing and said briskly, Commander Dessler, you have orders from the Crown Princess. You will place yourself, your ship, and your crew at her disposal until further notice, for the purpose of hunting down the fugitive Xenia Layla Dessler and delivering her up to Imperial justice.
So am I commanded, Garin replied stiffly.
So must I obey. Then notify command as to your Imperial orders, and prepare your vessel for departure. We leave tomorrow. She dropped the military stance and added in a wry mutter,
If Bashir will let us out of here...